with slick darkness. His eyes bulged. He thought of the way the blood had come spraying from Deke's mouth in an almost solid rope, the way Deke's eyes had bugged out as if on springs as hemorrhages caused by hydrostatic pressure pulped his brain. It smells me. It knows I'm here. Can it come up? Can it get up through the cracks? Can it? Can it? He stared down, unaware of Laverne's limp weight now, fascinated by the enormity of the question, wondering what the stuff would feel like when it flowed over his feet, when it hooked into him. The black shininess humped up almost to the edge of the cracks. Randy rose on tiptoes without being at all aware he was doing it. And then it went down. That canvassy slithering resumed, and suddenly Randy saw it on the water again, a great dark mole now perhaps 15 feet across. It rose and fell with the mild wavelets, rose and fell, and when Randy began to see the colors pulsing evenly across it, he tore his eyes away. He put Laverne down, and as soon as his muscles unlocked, his arms began to shake wildly. He let them shake. He knelt beside her, her hair spread across the white boards in an irregular dark fan. He knelt and watched that dark mole on the water, ready to yank her up again if it showed any signs of moving. He began to slap her lightly, first one cheek and then the other, back and forth, like a second trying to bring a fighter around. Laverne didn't want to come around. Laverne did not want to pass go and collect $200 to take a ride on the Redding. Laverne had seen enough. But Randy couldn't guard her all night, lifting her like a canvas sack every time that thing moved, and you couldn't look at the thing too long. That was another thing. He had learned a trick, though. He hadn't learned it in college. He had learned it from a friend of his older brother's. This friend had been a paramedic in Nam, and he knew all sorts of tricks. How to catch head lice off a human scalp and make them race in a matchbox, how to cut cocaine with baby laxative, how to sew up deep cuts with ordinary needle and thread. One day, they had been talking about ways to bring abysmally drunken folks around so these abysmally drunken people wouldn't puke down their own throats and die, as Bon Scott, the lead singer of AC/DC, had done. "You want to bring someone around in a hurry?" the friend with a catalog of interesting tricks had said. "Try this." And he told Randy the trick which Randy now used. He leaned over and bit Laverne's earlobe as hard as he could. Hot, bitter blood squirted into his mouth. Laverne's eyelids flew up like window shades. She screamed in a hoarse, growling voice and struck out at him. Randy looked up and saw the far side of the thing only. The rest of it was already under the raft. It had moved with eerie, horrible, silent speed. He jerked Laverne up again, his muscles screaming protest, trying to knot into Charlie horses. She was beating at his face. One of her hands struck his sensitive nose, and he saw red stars. "Quit it," he shouted, shuffling his feet onto the boards. "Quit it, you bitch. It's under us again. Quit it, or I'll fucking drop you. I swear to God I will." Her arms immediately stopped flailing at him and closed quietly around his neck in a drowner's grip. Her eyes looked white in the swimming starlight. "Stop it." She didn't. "Stop it, Laverne. You're choking me." Tighter. Panic flared in his mind. The hollow clunk of the barrels had taken on a duller, muffled note. It was the thing underneath, he supposed. "I can't breathe." The hold loosened a little. "Now listen, I'm going to put you down. It's all right if you..." But "put you down" was all she had heard. Her arms tightened in that deadly grip again. His right hand was on her back. He hooked it into a claw and raked at her. She kicked her legs, mewling harshly, and for a moment he almost lost his balance. She felt it. Fright, rather than pain, made her stop struggling. "Stand on the boards."
"No."
Her air puffed a hot desert wind against his cheek. "It can't get you if you stand on the boards."
"No, don't put me down. It'll get me. I know it will. I know..."
He raked at her back again. She screamed in anger and pain and fear. "You get down or I'll drop you, Laverne." He lowered her slowly and carefully, both of them breathing in sharp little whines, oboe and flute. Her feet touched the boards. She jerked her legs up as if the boards were hot.
"Put them down," he hissed at her. "I'm not Deke. I can't hold you all night."
"Deke?"
"Dead."
Her feet touched the boards. Little by little, he let go of her. They faced each other like dancers. He could see her waiting for its first touch. Her mouth gaped like the mouth of a goldfish.
"Randy,"
she whispered.
"Where is it?"
Under. Look down. She did. He did. They saw the blackness stuffing the cracks, stuffing them almost all the way across the raft now. Randy sensed its eagerness and thought she did, too.
Randy, please.
Shh. They stood there. Randy had forgotten to strip off his watch when he ran into the water, and now he marked off 15 minutes. At 8:15, the black thing slid out from under the raft again. It drew about 15 feet off, and then stopped, as it had before. "I'm going to sit down," he said.
"No!"
"I'm tired," he said. "I'm going to sit down, and you're going to watch it. Just remember to keep looking away. Then I'll get up, and you sit down. We go like that, here." He gave her his watch. 15-minute shifts.
"It ate Deke," she whispered.
"Yes."
"What is it?"
"I don't know."
"I'm cold."
"Me too."
"Hold me then."
"I've held you enough." She subsided. Sitting down was heaven. Not having to watch the thing was bliss. He watched Laverne instead, making sure that her eyes kept shifting away from the thing on the water.
"What are we going to do, Randy?"
he thought. "Wait," he said. At the end of 15 minutes, he stood up and let her first sit and then lie down for 30 minutes. Then he got her on her feet again, and she stood for 15 minutes. They went back and forth. At 9:45, a cold rind of moon rose and beat a path across the water. At 10:30, a shrill, lonely cry rose, echoing across the water, and Laverne shrieked. "Shut up," he said. "It's just a loon."
"I'm freezing, Randy. I'm numb all over."
"I can't do anything about it."
"Hold me," she said. "You've got to. We'll hold each other. We can both sit down and watch it together."
He debated, but the cold sinking into his own flesh was now bone deep, and that decided him. "Okay." They sat together, arms wrapped around each other, and something happened. Natural or perverse, it happened. He felt himself stiffening. One of his hands found her breast, cupped in damp nylon, and squeezed. She made a sighing noise, and her hand stole to the crotch of his underpants. He slid his other hand down and found a place where there was some heat. He pushed her down on her back.
"No," she said, but the hand in his crotch began to move faster.
"I can see it," he said. His heartbeat had sped up again, pushing blood faster, pushing warmth toward the surface of his chilled, bare skin. "I can watch it." She murmured something, and he felt elastic slide down his hips to his upper thighs. He watched it. He slid upward, forward, into her. Warmth. God, she was warm there, at least. She made a guttural noise, and her fingers grabbed at his cold, clenched buttocks. He watched it. It wasn't moving. He watched it. He watched it closely. The tactile sensations were incredible, fantastic. He was not experienced, but neither was he a virgin. He had made love with 3 girls, and it had never been like this. She moaned and began to lift her hips. The raft rocked gently, like the world's hardest waterbed. The barrels underneath murmured hollowly. He watched it. The colors began to swirl, slowly now, sensuously, not threatening. He watched it, and he watched the colors. His eyes were wide. The colors were in his eyes. He wasn't cold now. He was hot now. Hot the way you got your first day back on the beach in early June, when you could feel the sun tightening your winter-white skin, reddening it, giving it some colors. Color, some tint. First day at the beach, first day of summer, drag out the Beach Boys oldies, drag out the Ramones. The Ramones were telling you that Sheena is a punk rocker. The Ramones were telling you that you can hitch a ride to Rockaway Beach. The sand, the beach, the colors moving, it's starting to move. And the feel of summer, the texture, Gary U.S. Bond, school is out and I can root for the Yankees from the bleachers. Girls in bikinis on the beach, the beach, the beach. Oh, do you love, love. The beach, do you love, love, I love. Firm breasts, fragrant with copper-tone oil, and if the bottom of the bikini was small enough, you might see some hair. Her hair. Her hair is in the, oh God, the water. Her hair is, He pulled back suddenly, trying to pull her up, but the thing moved with oily speed and tangled itself in her hair like a webbing of thick black glue, and when he pulled her up she was already screaming and she was heavy with it. It came out of the water in a twisting, gruesome membrane that rolled with flaring nuclear colors, scarlet vermilion, flaring emerald, sullen ochre. It flowed down over Laverne's face in a tide, obliterating it. Her feet kicked and drummed. The thing twisted and moved where her face had been. Blood ran down her neck in streams. Screaming, not hearing himself scream, Randy ran at her, put his foot against her hip and shoved. She went flopping and tumbling over the side, her legs like alabaster in the moonlight. For a few endless moments the water frothed and splashed against the side of the raft, as if someone had hooked the world's largest bass in there, and it was fighting like hell. Randy screamed. He screamed. And then, for variety, he screamed some more. Some half an hour later, long after the frantic splashing and struggling had ended, the loons began to scream back. That night was forever. The sky began to lighten in the east around 4:45, and he felt a sluggish rise in his spirit. It was momentary, as false as the dawn. He stood on the boards, his eyes half closed, his chin on his chest. He had been sitting on the boards until an hour ago, and had been suddenly awakened, without even knowing until then that he had fallen asleep, that was the scary part, by that unspeakable hissing canvas sound. He leaped to his feet bare seconds before the blackness began to suck eagerly for him between the boards. His breath whined in and out. He bit at his lip, making it bleed. "Asleep! You were asleep, you asshole!" The thing had oozed out from under again half an hour later, but he hadn't sat down again. He was afraid to sit down, afraid he would go to sleep, and that this time his mind wouldn't trip him awake in time. His feet were still planted squarely on the boards as a stronger light, real dawn this time, filled the east and the first morning birds began to sing. The sun came up, and by 6 o'clock the day was bright enough for him to be able to see the beach. Deke's Camaro, bright yellow, was right where Deke had parked it, nose in to the pole fence. A bright litter of shirts and sweaters and 4 pairs of jeans were twisted into little shapes along the beach. The sight of them filled him with fresh horror when he thought his capacity for horror must surely be exhausted. He could see his jeans, one leg pulled inside out, the pocket showing. His jeans looked so safe lying there on the sand, just waiting for him to come along and pull the inside out leg back through so it was right, grasping the pocket as he did so the change wouldn't fall out. He could almost feel them whispering up his legs, could feel himself buttoning the brass button above the fly. "Do you love? Yes, I love." He looked left, and there it was, black, round as a checker, floating lightly. Colors began to swirl across its hide, and he looked away quickly. "Go home," he croaked. "Go home, or go to California and find a Roger Corman movie to audition for." A plane droned somewhere far away, and he fell into a dozing fantasy. We are reported missing, the four of us. The search spreads outward from Horlicks. A farmer remembers being passed by a yellow Camaro going like a bat out of hell. The search centers in the Cascade Lake area. Private pilots volunteered to do a quick aerial search, and one guy, buzzing the lake in his Beechcraft Twin Bonanza, sees a kid standing naked on the raft. One kid, one survivor, one... He caught himself on the edge of toppling over and brought his fist into his nose again, screaming at the pain. The black thing arrowed at the raft immediately and squeezed underneath. It could hear, perhaps, or sense, or something. Randy waited. This time, it was 45 minutes before it came out. His mind slowly orbited in the growing light. "Do you love?" "Yes, I love rooting for the Yankees and catfish." "Do you love the catfish?" "Yes, I love the Route 66. Remember the Corvette? George Maharis in the Corvette? Martin Milner in the Corvette? Do you love the Corvette?" "Yes, I love the Corvette." "I love... Do you love?" "So hot. The sun is like a burning glass, and it was in her hair, and it's the light I remember best, the light, the summer light of..." afternoon. Randy was crying. He was crying because something new had been added now. Every time he tried to sit down, the thing slid under the raft. It wasn't entirely stupid then. It had either sensed or figured out that it could get at him while he was sitting down.
"Go away!"
Randy wept at the great black mole floating on the water. 50 yards away, mockingly close, a squirrel was scampering back and forth on the hood of Deke's Camaro.
"Go away! Please, go anywhere but leave me alone! I don't love you!"
The thing didn't move. Colors began to swirl across its visible surface. "You do. You do love me." Randy tore his eyes away and looked at the beach, looked for rescue, but there was no one there, no one at all. His jeans still lay there, one leg inside out, the white lining of one pocket showing. They no longer looked to him as if someone was going to pick them up. They looked like relics. He thought, if I had a gun, I would kill myself now. He stood on the raft. The sun went down. 3 hours later, the moon came up. Not long after that, the loons began to scream. Not long after that, Randy turned and looked at the black thing on the water. He could not kill himself, but perhaps the thing could fix it so there was no pain. Perhaps that was what the colors were for. Do you love? He looked for it, and it was there, floating, riding the waves. "Sing with me," Randy croaked. "I can root for the Yankees from the bleachers. I don't have to worry about teachers. I'm so glad that school is out. I am gonna sing and shout." The colors began to form and twist. This time Randy did not look away. He whispered, "Do you love?" Somewhere, far across the empty lake, a loon screamed.
Word Processor of the Gods. Read by Norbert Leo Butz.
At first glance, it looked like a Wang word processor. It had a Wang keyboard and a Wang casing. It was only on second glance that Richard Hagstrom saw that the casing had been split open, and not gently, either. It looked to him as if the job had been done with a hacksaw blade, to admit a slightly larger IBM cathode tube. The archive disks which had come with this odd mongrel were not floppy at all. They were as hard as the 45s Richard had listened to as a kid. "What in the name of God is that?" Lena asked as he and Mr. Nordhoff lugged it over to his study piece by piece. Mr. Nordhoff had lived next door to Richard Hagstrom's brother's family, Roger, Belinda, and their boy, Jonathan. "Something John built," Richard said. "Meant for me to have it, Mr. Nordhoff says. It looks like a word processor." "Oh, yeah," Nordhoff said. He would not see his 60s again, and he was badly out of breath. "That's what he said it was, the poor kid. Think we could set it down for a minute, Mr. Hagstrom? I'm pooped." "You bet," Richard said, and then called to his son, Seth, who was tooling odd atonal chords out of his Fender guitar downstairs. The room Richard had envisioned as a family room, when he had first paneled it, had become his son's rehearsal hall instead. "Seth," he yelled, "come give us a hand." Downstairs, Seth just went on warping chords out of the Fender. Richard looked at Mr. Nordhoff and shrugged, ashamed and unable to hide it. Nordhoff shrugged back as if to say, "Kids, who expects anything better from them these days?" Except they both knew that John, poor doomed John Hagstrom, his crazy brother's son, had been better. "You were good to help me with this," Richard said. Nordhoff shrugged.
"What else has an old man got to do with his time? And I guess it was the least I could do for Johnny. He used to cut my lawn gratis, do you know that? I wanted to pay him, but the kid wouldn't take it. He was quite a boy."
Nordhoff was still out of breath.
You think I gotta have a glass of water, Mr. Hagstrom?
You bet. He got it himself when his wife didn't move from the kitchen table, where she was reading a bodice ripper paperback and eating a Twinkie. Seth, he yelled again, come on up here and help us, okay? But Seth just went on playing muffled and rather soured bar chords on the Fender, for which Richard was still paying. He invited Nordhoff to stay for supper, but Nordhoff refused politely. Richard nodded, embarrassed again, but perhaps hiding it a little better this time. What's a nice guy like you doing with a family like that? His friend Bernie Epstein had asked him once. And Richard had only been able to shake his head, feeling the same dull embarrassment he was feeling now. He was a nice guy, and yet somehow this was what he had come out with, an overweight, sullen wife who felt cheated out of the good things in life, who felt that she had backed the losing horse, but who would never come right out and say so, and an uncommunicative 15-year-old son who was doing marginal work in the same school where Richard taught. A son who played weird chords on the guitar morning, noon, and night, mostly night, and who seemed to think that would somehow be enough to get him through. Well, how about a beer? Richard asked. He was reluctant to let Nordhoff go. He wanted to hear more about John.
Beer would taste awful good, Nordhoff said, and Richard nodded gratefully.
Fine, he said, and went back to get them a couple of buds. His study was in a small shed-like building that stood apart from the house. Like the family room, he had fixed it up himself. But unlike the family room, this was a place he thought of as his own, a place where he could shut out the stranger he had married and the stranger she had given birth to. Lena did not, of course, approve of him having his own place, but she had not been able to stop it. It was one of the few little victories he had managed over her. He supposed that in a way she had backed a losing horse. When they had gotten married 16 years before, they had both believed he would write wonderful, lucrative novels, and they would both soon be driving around in Mercedes-Benzes. But the one novel he had published had not been lucrative, and the critics had been quick to point out that it wasn't very wonderful either. Lena had seen things the critics' way, and that had been the beginning of their drifting apart. So, the high school teaching job, which both of them had seen as only a stepping stone on their way to fame, glory, and riches, had now been their major source of income for the last 15 years. One hell of a long stepping stone, he sometimes thought. But he had never quite let go of his dream. He wrote short stories and the occasional article. He was a member in good standing of the Authors Guild. He brought in about $5,000 in additional income with his typewriter each year. And no matter how much Lena might grouse about it, that rated him his own study, especially since she refused to work.
You've got a nice place here, Nordhoff said, looking around the small room with a mixture of old-fashioned prints on the walls.
The mongrel word processor sat on the desk with the CPU tucked underneath. Richard's old Olivetti Electric had been put aside for the time being on top of one of the filing cabinets. It serves the purpose, Richard said. He nodded at the word processor. You don't suppose that thing really works, do you? John was only 14.
Looks funny, doesn't it?
It sure does, Richard agreed. Nordhoff laughed.
You don't know the half of it, he said. I peeked down into the back of the video unit. Some of the wires are stamped IBM, and some are stamped Radio Shack. There's most of a Western Electric telephone in there. And believe it or not, there's a small motor from an Erector set.
He sipped his beer and said in a kind of afterthought,
15. He just turned 15, a couple of days before the accident.
He paused and said it again, looking down at his bottle of beer.
15.
He didn't say it loudly.
Erector set?
Richard blinked at the old man.
That's right. Erector set puts out an electric model kit. John had one of them since he was, maybe 6. I gave it to him for Christmas one year. He was crazy for gadgets even then. Any kind of gadget would do him. And did that little box of Erector set motors tickle him? I guess it did. He kept it for almost 10 years. Not many kids do that, Mr. Hagstrom.
No, Richard said, thinking of the boxes of Seth's toys he had lugged out over the years, discarded, forgotten, or wantonly broken. He glanced at the word processor. It doesn't work then.
I wouldn't bet on it until you try it, Nordhoff said. The kid was damn near an electrical genius.
Well, that's sort of pushing it, I think. I know he was good with gadgets, and he won the state science fair when he was in the sixth grade.
Competing against kids who were much older. High school seniors, some of them, Nordhoff said. Or that's what his mother said.
It's true. We were all very proud of him. Which wasn't exactly true. Richard had been proud, and John's mother had been proud. The boy's father didn't give a shit at all. But science fair projects and building your very own hybrid word cruncher, he shrugged. Nordhoff set his beer down.
There was a kid back in the 50s, he said, who made an atom smasher out of 2 soup cans and about $5 worth of electrical equipment. John told me about that. And he said there was a kid out in some hick town in New Mexico who discovered tachyons, negative particles that are supposed to travel backwards through time, in 1954. A kid in Waterbury, Connecticut, 11 years old, who made a pipe bomb out of the celluloid he scraped off the backs of a deck of playing cards. He blew up an empty doghouse with it. Kids are funny sometimes, the super smart ones in particular. You might be surprised.
Maybe. Maybe I will be.
He was a fine boy, regardless.
You loved him a little, didn't you?
Mr. Hagstrom,
Nordhoff said.
I loved him a lot. He was a genuinely all right kid.
And Richard thought how strange it was. His brother, who had been an utter shit since the age of 6, had gotten a fine woman and a fine bright son. He himself, who had always tried to be gentle and good, whatever good meant in this crazy world, had married Lena, who had developed into a silent piggy woman and had gotten Seth by her. Looking at Nordhoff's honest, tired face, he found himself wondering exactly how that had happened, and how much of it had been his own fault, a natural result of his own quiet weakness. Yes, Richard said, he was, wasn't he?
Wouldn't surprise me if it worked, Nordhoff said. Wouldn't surprise me at all.
After Nordhoff had gone, Richard Hagstrom plugged the word processor in and turned it on. There was a hum, and he waited to see if the letters IBM would come up on the face of the screen. They did not. Instead, eerily, like a voice from the grave, these words swam up, green ghosts from the darkness. Happy birthday, Uncle Richard. John.
Christ, Richard whispered, sitting down hard.
The accident that had killed his brother, his wife, and their son had happened 2 weeks before. They had been coming back from some sort of day trip, and Roger had been drunk. Being drunk was a perfectly ordinary occurrence in the life of Roger Hagstrom. But this time his luck had simply run out, and he had driven his dusty old van off the edge of a 90-foot drop. It had crashed and burned. John was 15. Just turned 15 a couple of days before the accident, the old man said. Another 3 years and he would have gotten free of that hulking, stupid bear. His birthday, and mine, coming up soon. A week from today, the word processor had been John's birthday present for him. That made it worse, somehow. Richard could not have said precisely how or why, but it did. He reached out to turn off the screen and then withdrew his hand.
Some kid made an atom smasher out of 2 soup cans and $5 worth of auto electrical parts.
Yeah, and the New York City sewer system is full of alligators, and the U.S. Air Force has the body of an alien on ice somewhere in Nebraska. Tell me a few more. It's bullshit. But maybe that's something I don't want to know for sure. He got up, went around to the back of the VDT, and looked through the slots. Yes, it was as Nordhoff had said. Wire-stamped Radio Shack made in Taiwan, wire-stamped Western Electric, and Westrix, and Erector Set, with the little circled trademark R. And he saw something else, something Nordhoff had either missed or hadn't wanted to mention. There was a Lionel Train transformer in there, wired up like the Bride of Frankenstein.
Christ, he said,
laughing, but suddenly near tears.
Christ, Johnny, what did you think you were doing?
But he knew that, too. He had dreamed and talked about owning a word processor for years, and when Lena's laughter became too sarcastic to bear, he had talked about it to John. I could write faster, rewrite faster, and submit more, he remembered telling John last summer. The boy had looked at him seriously, his light blue eyes, intelligent but always so carefully wary, magnified behind his glasses. It would be great, really great. Then why don't you get one, Uncle Rich? They don't exactly give them away, Richard had said, smiling. The Radio Shack model starts at around $3,000. From there, you can work yourself up into the $18,000 range. Well, maybe I'll build you one sometime, John had said. Maybe you just will, Richard had said, clapping him on the back. And until Nordoff had called, he had thought no more about it. Wires from Hobby Shop electrical models. A Lionel train transformer. Christ. He went around to the front again, meaning to turn it off, as if to actually try to write something on it and fail would somehow defile what his earnest, fragile, doomed nephew had intended. Instead, he pushed the execute button on the board. A funny little chill scraped across his spine as he did it. Execute was a funny word to use when you thought of it. It wasn't a word he associated with writing. It was a word he associated with gas chambers and electric chairs, and perhaps with dusty old vans plunging off the sides of roads. Execute. The CPU was humming louder than any he had ever heard on the occasions when he had window-shopped word processors. It was, in fact, almost roaring. What's in the memory box, John? He wondered. Bedsprings? Train transformers all in a row? Soup cans? He thought again of John's eyes, of his still and delicate face. Was it strange, maybe even sick, to be jealous of another man's son? But he should have been mine. I knew it, and I think he knew it, too. And then there was Belinda, Roger's wife. Belinda, who wore sunglasses too often on cloudy days. The big ones, because those bruises around the eyes have a nasty way of spreading. But he looked at her sometimes, sitting there still and watchful in the loud umbrella of Roger's laughter, and he thought almost the exact same thing. She should have been mine. It was a terrifying thought, because they had both known Belinda in high school and had both dated her. He and Roger had been 2 years apart in age, and Belinda had been perfectly between them, a year older than Richard and a year younger than Roger. Richard had actually been the first to date the girl who would grow up to become John's mother. Then Roger had stepped in. Roger, who was older and bigger. Roger, who always got what he wanted. Roger, who would hurt you if you tried to stand in his way. I got scared. I got scared and I let her get away. Was it as simple as that? Dear God, help me. I think it was. I'd like to have it a different way, but perhaps it's best not to lie to yourself about such things as cowardice and shame. And if those things were true, if Lena and Seth had somehow belonged with his no good of a brother, and if Belinda and John had somehow belonged with him, what did that prove? And exactly how was a thinking person supposed to deal with such an absurdly balanced screw-up? Did you laugh? Did you scream? Did you shoot yourself for a yellow dog?
Wouldn't surprise me if it worked. Wouldn't surprise me at all.
Execute. His fingers moved swiftly over the keys. He looked at the screen and saw these letters floating green on the surface of the screen. My brother was a worthless drunk. They floated there, and Richard suddenly thought of a toy he had when he was a kid. It was called a magic eight ball. You asked it a question that could be answered yes or no, and then you turned the magic eight ball over to see what it had to say on the subject. Its phony yet somehow entrancingly mysterious responses included such things as, "It is almost certain," "I would not plan on it," and "Ask again later." Roger had been jealous of that toy, and finally, after bullying Richard into giving it to him one day, Roger had thrown it onto the sidewalk as hard as he could, breaking it. Then he had laughed. Sitting here now, listening to the strangely choppy roar from the CPU cabinet John had jury-rigged, Richard remembered how he had collapsed to the sidewalk, weeping, unable to believe his brother had done such a thing. "Ball, baby, ball, baby, look at the baby ball," Roger had taunted him. "It wasn't nothing but a cheap, shitty toy anyway, Richie. Look at there, nothing in it but a bunch of little signs, and a lot of water."
"I'm telling,"
Richard had shrieked at the top of his lungs. His head felt hot. His sinuses were stuffed shut with tears of outrage.
"I'm telling on you, Roger. I'm telling Mom."
"You tell, and I'll break your arm," Roger said. And in his chilling grin, Richard had seen he meant it. He had not told. My brother was a worthless drunk. Well, weirdly put together or not, it screen printed. Whether it would store information in the CPU still remained to be seen, but John's mating of a Wang board to an IBM screen had actually worked. Just coincidentally, it called up some pretty crappy memories, but he didn't suppose that was John's fault. He looked around his office, and his eyes happened to fix on the one picture in here that he hadn't picked and didn't like. It was a studio portrait of Lena, her Christmas present to him 2 years ago. "I want you to hang it in your study," she'd said. And so, of course, he had done just that. It was, he supposed, her way of keeping an eye on him, even when she wasn't here. "Don't forget me, Richard. I'm here. Maybe I backed the wrong horse, but I'm still here. And you better remember it." The studio portrait, with its unnatural tints, went oddly with the amiable mixture of prints by Whistler, Homer, and N.C. Wyeth. Lena's eyes were half-lidded, the heavy Cupid's bow of her mouth composed in something that was not quite a smile. "Still here, Richard," her mouth said to him, "and don't you forget it." He typed, "My wife's photograph hangs on the west wall of my study." He looked at the words and liked them no more than he liked the picture itself. He punched the delete button. The words vanished. Now there was nothing at all on the screen but the steadily pulsing cursor. He looked up at the wall and saw that his wife's picture had also vanished. He sat there for a very long time. It felt that way, at least, looking at the wall where the picture had been. What finally brought him out of his days of utter unbelieving shock was the smell from the CPU, a smell he remembered from his childhood as clearly as he remembered the magic eight-ball Roger had broken because it wasn't his. The smell was essence of electric train transformer. When you smelled that, you were supposed to turn the thing off so it could cool down. And so he would. In a minute. He got up and walked over to the wall on legs which felt numb. He ran his fingers over the Armstrong paneling. The picture had been here, yes, right here. But it was gone now. And the hook it had hung on was gone, and there was no hole where he had screwed the hook into the paneling. Gone. The world abruptly went gray, and he staggered backwards, thinking dimly that he was going to faint. He held on grimly until the world swam back into focus. He looked from the blank space on the wall where Lena's picture had been to the word processor his dead nephew had cobbled together.
"You might be surprised," he heard Nordoff saying in his mind. "You might be surprised, you might be surprised. Oh, yes. If some kid in the 50s could discover particles that travel backwards through time, you might be surprised what your genius of a nephew could do with a bunch of discarded word processor elements and some wires and electrical components. You might be so surprised that you'll feel as if you're going insane."
The transformer smell was richer, stronger now, and he could see wisps of smoke rising from the vents in the screen housing. The noise from the CPU was louder, too. It was time to turn it off. Smart as John had been, he apparently hadn't had time to work out all the bugs in the crazy thing. But had he known it would do this? Feeling like a figment of his own imagination, Richard sat down in front of the screen again and typed, "My wife's picture is on the wall." He looked at this for a moment, looked back at the keyboard, and then hit the execute key. He looked at the wall. Lena's picture was back, right where it had always been.
"Jesus," he whispered, "Jesus Christ."
He rubbed a hand up his cheek, looked at the keyboard, blank again now except for the cursor, and then typed, "My floor is bare." He then touched the insert button and typed, except for 12 $20 gold pieces in a small cotton sack. He pressed execute. He looked at the floor, where there was now a small white cotton sack with a drawstring top. Wells Fargo was stenciled on the bag in faded black ink. "Dear Jesus," he heard himself saying in a voice that wasn't his. "Oh, dear Jesus, dear good Jesus." He might have gone on invoking the Savior's name for minutes or hours if the word processor had not started beeping at him steadily. Flashing across the top of the screen was the word overload. Richard turned off everything in a hurry and left his study as if all the devils of hell were after him. But before he went, he scooped up the small drawstring sack and put it in his pants pocket. When he called Nordhoff that evening, a cold November wind was playing tuneless bagpipes in the trees outside. Seth's group was downstairs murdering a Bob Seger tune. Lena was out at Our Lady of Perpetual Sorrows playing bingo.
"Does the machine work?" Nordhoff asked.
"It works all right," Richard said. He reached into his pocket and brought out a coin. It was heavy, heavier than a Rolex watch. An eagle's stern profile was embossed on one side, along with the date 1871. "It works in ways you wouldn't believe."
"I might," Nordhoff said evenly. "He was a very bright boy, and he loved you very much, Mr. Hagstrom. But be careful. A boy is only a boy, bright or otherwise, and love can be misdirected. Do you take my meaning?"
Richard didn't take his meaning at all. He felt hot and feverish. That day's paper had listed the current market price of gold at $514 an ounce. The coins had weighed out at an average of 4.5 ounces each on his postal scale. At the current market rate, that added up to $27,756, and he guessed that was perhaps only a quarter of what he could realize for those coins if he sold them as coins. "Mr. Nordhoff, could you come over here now, tonight?"
"No,"
Nordhoff said.
"No, I don't think I want to do that, Mr. Hagstrom. I think this ought to stay between you and John. But just remember what I said. For Christ's sake, be careful."
There was a small click, and Nordhoff was gone. He found himself out in his study again, half an hour later, looking at the word processor. He touched the on-off key, but didn't turn it on just yet. The second time Nordhoff said it, Richard had heard it.
"For Christ's sake, be careful."
Yes, he would have to be careful. A machine that could do such a thing. How could a machine do such a thing? He had no idea. But in a way, that made the whole crazy thing easier to accept. He was an English teacher and sometime writer, not a technician. And he had a long history of not understanding how things worked. Phonographs, gasoline engines, telephones, televisions, the flushing mechanism in his toilet. His life had been a history of understanding operations rather than principles. Was there any difference here, except in degree? He turned the machine on. As before, it said, "Happy birthday, Uncle Richard. John." He pushed execute, and the message from his nephew disappeared. "This machine is not going to work for long," he thought suddenly. He felt sure that John must have still been working on it when he died, confident that there was time. Uncle Richard's birthday wasn't for 3 weeks, after all. But time had run out for John, and so this totally amazing word processor, which could apparently insert new things or delete old things from the real world, smelled like a frying train transformer and started to smoke after a few minutes. John hadn't had a chance to perfect it. He had been confident that there was time. But that was wrong. That was all wrong. Richard knew it. John's still watchful face, the sober eyes behind the thick spectacles. There was no confidence there, no belief in the comforts of time. What was the word that had occurred to him earlier that day? Doomed. It wasn't just a good word for John, it was the right word. That sense of doom had hung about the boy so palpably that there had been times when Richard had wanted to hug him, to tell him to lighten up a little bit, that sometimes there were happy endings, and the good didn't always die young. Then he thought of Roger throwing his magic eight ball at the sidewalk, throwing it just as hard as he could. He heard the plastic splinter and saw the eight ball's magic fluid, just water, after all, running down the sidewalk. And this picture merged with a picture of Roger's mongrel van, Hagstrom's Wholesale Deliveries written on the side, plunging over the edge of some dusty, crumbling cliff out in the country, hitting dead squat on its nose with a noise that was, like Roger himself, no big deal. He saw, although he didn't want to, the face of his brother's wife disintegrate into blood and bone. He saw John burning in the wreck, screaming, turning black. No confidence, no real hope. He had always exuded a sense of time running out, and in the end he had turned out to be right. What does that mean? Richard muttered, looking at the blank screen. How would the magic eight ball have answered that? Ask again later? Outcome is murky? Or perhaps, it is certainly so. The noise coming from the CPU was getting louder again, and more quickly than this afternoon. Already, he could smell the train transformer John had lodged in the machinery behind the screen getting hot. Magic Dream Machine. Word processor of the gods. Was that what it was? Was that what John had intended to give his uncle for his birthday? The space-age equivalent of a magic lamp or a wishing well? He heard the back door of the house bang open, and then the voices of Seth and the other members of Seth's band. The voices were too loud, too raucous. They had either been drinking or smoking dope. "Where's your old man, Seth?" he heard one of them ask. "Goofing off in his study like usual, I guess," Seth said. "I think he..." The wind rose again then, blurring the rest, but not blurring their vicious tribal laughter. Richard sat listening to them, his head cocked a little to one side, and suddenly he typed, "My son is Seth Robert Hagstrom." His finger hovered over the delete button. "What are you doing?" his mind screamed at him. "Can you be serious? Do you intend to murder your own son?"
"He must do something in there," one of the others said. "He's a goddamn dimwit," Seth answered. "You ask my mother sometime, she'll tell you. He..."
"I'm not going to murder him. I'm going to delete him." His finger stabbed down on the button.
"Ain't never done nothing, but..."
The words, "My son is Seth Robert Hagstrom," vanished from the screen. Outside, Seth's words vanished with them. There was no sound out there now but the cold November wind, blowing grim advertisements for winter. Richard turned off the word processor and went outside. The driveway was empty. The group's lead guitarist, Norm somebody, drove a monstrous and somehow sinister old LTD station wagon in which the group carried their equipment to their infrequent gigs. It was not parked in the driveway now. Perhaps it was somewhere in the world, tooling down some highway or parked in the parking lot of some greasy hamburger hangout. And Norm was also somewhere in the world, as was Davey, the bassist, whose eyes were frighteningly blank and who wore a safety pin dangling from one earlobe, as was the drummer, who had no front teeth. They were somewhere in the world, somewhere, but not here, because Seth wasn't here. Seth had never been here. Seth had been deleted. "I have no son," Richard muttered. How many times had he read that melodramatic phrase in bad novels? 100? 200? It had never rung true to him, but here it was true. Now it was true. Oh, yes. The wind gusted, and Richard was suddenly seized by a vicious stomach cramp that doubled him over, gasping. He passed explosive wind. When the cramps passed, he walked into the house. The first thing he noticed was that Seth's ratty tennis shoes, he had four pairs of them and refused to throw any of them out, were gone from the front hall. He went to the stairway banister and ran his thumb over a section of it. At age 10, old enough to know better, but Lena had refused to allow Richard to lay a hand on the boy in spite of that, Seth had carved his initials deeply into the wood of that banister, wood which Richard had labored over for almost one whole summer. He had sanded and filled and revarnished, but the ghost of those initials had remained. They were gone now. Upstairs, Seth's room. It was neat and clean and unlived in, dry and devoid of personality. It might as well have had a sign on the doorknob reading, "Guest Room." Downstairs. And it was here that Richard lingered the longest. The snarls of wire were gone. The amplifiers and microphones were gone. The litter of tape recorder parts that Seth was always going to fix up were gone. He did not have John's hands or concentration. Instead, the room bore the deep, if not particularly pleasant, stamp of Lena's personality. Heavy, florid furniture, and saccharine velvet tapestries, one depicting a Last Supper, at which Christ looked like Wayne Newton, another showing deer against a sunset Alaskan skyline. A glaring rug as bright as arterial blood. There was no longer the faintest sense that a boy named Seth Hagstrom had once inhabited this room. This room, or any of the other rooms in the house. Richard was still standing at the foot of the stairs and looking around when he heard a car pull into the driveway. Lena, he thought, and felt a surge of almost frantic guilt. It's Lena, back from bingo, and what's she going to say when she sees that Seth is gone?
What?
Murderer, he heard her screaming.
You murdered my boy!
But he hadn't murdered Seth. I deleted him, he muttered, and went upstairs to meet her in the kitchen. Lena was fatter. He had sent a woman off to bingo who weighed 180 pounds or so. The woman who came back in weighed at least 300, perhaps more. She had to twist slightly sideways to get in through the back door. Elephantine hips and thighs rippled in tidal motions beneath polyester slacks the color of overripe green olives. Her skin, merely sallow 3 hours ago, was now sickly and pale. Although he was no doctor, Richard thought he could read serious liver damage or incipient heart disease in that skin. Her heavy-lidded eyes regarded Richard with a steady, even contempt. She was carrying the frozen corpse of a huge turkey in one of her flabby hands. It twisted and turned within its cellophane wrapper like the body of a bizarre suicide.
"What are you staring at, Richard?" she asked.
"You, Lena, I'm staring at you. Because this is how you turned out in a world where we had no children. This is how you turned out in a world where there was no object for your love. Poisoned as your love might be. This is how Lena looks in a world where everything comes in and nothing at all goes out. You, Lena, that's what I'm staring at, you." "That bird, Lena," he managed finally. "That's one of the biggest damn turkeys I've ever seen."
"Well, don't just stand there looking at it, idiot. Help me with it."
He took the turkey and put it on the counter, feeling its waves of cheerless cold. It sounded like a block of wood.
"Not there," she cried impatiently, and gestured toward the pantry. "It's not going to fit in there. Put it in the freezer."
"Sorry," he murmured. They had never had a freezer before. Never in the world where there had been a Seth. He took the turkey into the pantry, where a long amana freezer sat under cold white fluorescent tubes, like a cold white coffin. He put it inside, along with the cryogenically preserved corpses of other birds and beasts, and then went back into the kitchen. Lena had taken the jar of Reese's peanut butter cups from the cupboard and was eating them methodically, one after the other.
"It was the Thanksgiving bingo," she said. "We had it this week instead of next because next week Father Phillips has to go in hospital and have his gallbladder out."
"I won the coverall." She smiled. A brown mixture of chocolate and peanut butter dripped and ran from her teeth. "Lena," he said, "are you ever sorry we never had children?" She looked at him as if he had gone utterly crazy.
"What in the name of God would I want a rug monkey for?" she asked.
She shoved the jar of peanut butter cups, now reduced by half, back into the cupboard.
"I'm going to bed. Are you coming? Are you going to go back out there and moon over your typewriter some more?"
"I'll go out for a little while more, I think," he said. His voice was surprisingly steady. "I won't be long."
"Does that gadget work?" What?
Then he understood, and he felt another flash of guilt. She knew about the word processor, of course she did. Seth's deletion had not affected Roger and the track that Roger's family had been on. Oh, no, it doesn't do anything. She nodded, satisfied.
That nephew of yours had always in the clouds, just like you, Richard. If you weren't such a mouse, I'd wonder if maybe you'd been putting it where you hadn't ought to have been putting it about 15 years ago.
She laughed a coarse, surprisingly powerful laugh, the laugh of an aging, cynical bawd, and for a moment he almost leaped at her. Then he felt a smile surface on his own lips, a smile as thin and white and cold as the amount of freezer that had replaced Seth on this new track. I won't be long, he said. I just want to note down a few things. Why don't you write a Nobel Prize-winning short story or something, she asked indifferently. The hall floorboards creaked and muttered as she swayed her huge way toward the stairs.
We still owe the optometrist for my reading glasses, and we're a payment behind on the Betamax. Why don't you make us some damn money?
Well, Richard said, I don't know, Lena, but I've got some good ideas tonight. I really do. She turned to look at him, seemed about to say something sarcastic. Something about how none of his good ideas had put them on Easy Street, but she had stuck with him anyway. And then didn't. Perhaps something about his smile deterred her. She went upstairs. Richard stood below, listening to her thundering tread. He could feel sweat on his forehead. He felt simultaneously sick and exhilarated. He turned and went back out to his study. This time, when he turned the unit on, the CPU did not hum or roar. It began to make an uneven howling noise. The hot train transformer smell came almost immediately from the housing behind the screen, and as soon as he pushed the execute button, erasing the Happy Birthday Uncle Richard message, the unit began to smoke. Not much time, he thought. No, that's not right. No time at all. John knew it, and now I know it too. The choices came down to two. Bring Seth back with the insert button. He was sure he could do it. It would be as easy as creating the Spanish doubloons had been. Or finish the job. The smell was getting thicker, more urgent. In a few moments, surely no more, the screen would start blinking its overload message. He typed, My wife is Adelina Mabel Warren Hagstrom. He punched the delete button. He typed, I am a man who lives alone. Now the word began to blink steadily in the upper right-hand corner of the screen. Overload, overload, overload. Please, please let me finish. Please, please, please. The smoke coming from the vents in the video cabinet was thicker and grayer now. He looked down at the screaming CPU and saw that smoke was also coming from its vents. And down in that smoke, he could see a sullen red spark of fire. Magic 8-Ball, will I be healthy, wealthy, or wise? Or will I live alone and perhaps kill myself in sorrow? Is there time enough? Cannot see now. Try again later. Except there was no later. He struck the insert button, and the screen went dark, except for the constant overload message, which was now blinking at a frantic, stuttery rate. He typed, Except for my wife, Belinda, and my son, Jonathan. Please, please. He hit the execute button. The screen went blank. For what seemed like ages, it remained blank. Except for overload, which was now blinking so fast that except for a faint shadow, it seemed to remain constant. Like a computer executing a closed loop of command. Something inside the CPU popped and sizzled, and Richard groaned. Then green letters appeared on the screen, floating mystically on the black. I am a man who lives alone, except for my wife, Belinda, and my son, Jonathan. He hit the execute button twice. Now, he thought, now I will type all the bugs in this word processor. Were fully worked out before Mr. Nordhoff brought it over here. Or I'll type, I have ideas for at least 20 best-selling novels. Or I'll type, my family and I are going to live happily ever after. Or I'll type. But he typed nothing. His fingers hovered stupidly over the keys as he felt, literally,